All right, right now we got an interview for you guys that I'm super excited about. Shepherd Fairey's in the studio. I think it's fair to call you the top and certainly best known street artist in the country. And I don't know how you feel about that title, but I've now given it to you, whether you like it or dislike it. And you've got some, of course, some legendary work, Obey, which I want to talk to you about in a second, and the Hope poster for Obama. I'm curious about the backstory of that too. You're also working on a whole bunch of stuff now. Your book, Obey, Supply and Demand, The Art of Shepherd Fairey's back out. You got the documentary Obey Giant on Hulu. Mm-hmm. I was going to say more important, just as important. No, probably more important to be fair, and I think you'd agree, is the Equal Justice Initiative, which is actually trying to seek justice in the country. So it's a long intro to, hey, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up? How did you get into art? Did you always know that you were going to do this? Or did you think you were going to be an accountant at some point?
Well, I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. And I like to draw from the time I was a little kid. But what really, I think, made me think art is going to be my thing is when I got into skateboarding and punk rock. And then there was this do-it-yourself creative side of the culture. And all the art that I'd been doing was pretty traditional because that's all I was exposed to. But then with skateboarding and punk rock, there was a lot of stencil making, stickers, making homemade t-shirts. And then all the bands making flyers and promoting themselves. So, you know, that started to push me in a more progressive direction, even though I still didn't necessarily see making homemade t-shirts and stickers as the same thing as trying to paint like Michelangelo or something. But then I went to a year of art boarding school out here in Idlewild, up in the mountains. But we went into LA and I saw an artist named Robbie Canal, who did posters parodying Ronald Reagan. He did a lot of other leaders too, but I just happened to be in a school van driving around downtown LA and seeing these unflattering portraits of Reagan with the word Contra above and Diction below. And I was listening to the Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, and that Reagan was a villain in 80s punk rock. So seeing this, it just struck me. I had an epiphany. This is what I want to do. It's got social commentary, a sense of humor. It's well painted. So I didn't crystallize for me for a few more years, but I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So I interviewed Robbie too, and it's great to see that he was your original inspiration. So that's pretty neat to connect that. So so what's the first thing that you do on your own that is along those lines?
Well, when I was a freshman at the Rhode Island School of Design, I started doing some posters that were and t-shirts and stickers that were around issues of racism and control. I had a Stop Racism poster, which was, you know, a little one-dimensional. It was like a skinhead guy yelling at I use Miles Davis's eyes, but you know, a very forlorn looking African-American gentleman. And I mean, my heart was in the right place, but it was a little ham-fisted, I think. Then I had a thing of a skateboarder being grabbed by the police and it said, "Prevent police boredom, skateboard" underneath it.
See, that's clever, okay.
So, you know, because at the time there was the whole skateboarding's not a crime, but clearly the cops hadn't gotten that memo. And then I had a Question Authority shirt, but it was really when I started making the Andre the Giant Has a Posse sticker, putting those in public space and then seeing all the varied reactions like a Rorschach test, that I started to realize that art that questions the control of public space is powerful. Even though I started off with a really silly thing that was just meant to be an inside joke with some skateboard friends, I saw the potential to evolve that into something. You know, something that's it's just disrupting the usual semiotics of consumption, et cetera. I mean, I think they came up with the term around then in the early 90s of culture jamming. I didn't realize that wasn't what I was doing in a real thoughtful way, but then when I saw how people reacted to it, I studied things like the Situationist International and the idea of the spectacle. Jamie Reed and Malcolm McLaren, who worked with the Sex Pistols, who were my favorite group probably, had really thought about those principles and how they would disrupt things with the Sex Pistols. And then also Heidegger's theory of phenomenology, the idea that we've become so numb to our surroundings that it takes unusual encounters to reawaken a sense of wonder, to get us to analyze things more closely, question things. So as soon as I tapped into that, then I was on my way to the Obey Project.
See, that's really interesting. I saw some TV special about hypnosis. And the trick to hypnosis is doing something totally out of the ordinary that puts people in a different frame of mind. And as you were describing that, it almost sounded like that. And so I want to talk about it in the context of the Andre the Giant campaign. Mm-hmm. Because I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, what in the world is that? Right? You can't help but ask, what is that? Yeah. Or as my dad would say, what is this? Right? And why Obey? And why Andre the Giant? And I was a wrestling fan, and so I knew it was Andre, mm-hmm. But I didn't know why. So let's talk about how it originated, and then what it became to you and to others as it went along.
I was working at a skate shop the summer after my freshman year in college, making $4.25 an hour, and the crew of guys I skated with, we were all really getting into hip hop, and Posse was a big word in hip hop. The Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, N.W.A., Ice-T, they were all using the word posse. So we're calling our crew our posse. And hip hop had sort of become the new punk rock. Then I was also subsidizing my meager income from the skate shop by making a lot of homemade t-shirts, things like The Misfits, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, The Clash. And I would take those into the skate shop when my boss wasn't there, put them on the rack, and then when they sold, I'd keep the money. And then so a friend of mine wanted to learn how to make a stencil. So I looked through the Providence Journal and saw an ad for wrestling and said, oh, you gotta make a stencil of Andre the Giant. And he said, nah, that's stupid, man. So what are you talking about? Andre's posse is gonna be taken over. You and I will be the only ones that know we'll do this. When people ask, we'll say, sorry, it's top secret, we can't tell you. And he was like, hi, yeah, that's funny. He tried to cut it with an X-Acto knife, got frustrated. I finished it. It was made in 10 minutes or less. But then just went to Kinko's and ran off some stickers on Crack and Peel. Gave them to a few friends, but the next thing you know, people are coming up to me saying like, aren't you the guy with those stickers? Can I get a couple? And then I saw a guy with a baseball hat with one with paint flakes on it. He peeled it off something. It's so strange that this thing's got this mystery that's alluring. And then I decided, well, it's out there. I'm putting it at some skate spots, some clubs, stop signs. What if I actually make a real effort instead of just sort of doing it while I'm, wandering home at night. Then it grew a little more. And about a year later, I decided to change Buddy Cianci, the mayoral candidate's billboard around as excuse to do a prank, but also to fulfill an assignment for one of my illustration classes. And that ended up on the news, in the newspaper, on the radio. And I realized, when you go from a 3-inch sticker to a billboard, it really changes things. The conversation gets a lot bigger and louder. Then I was hooked. Because I felt powerless for so many years, and all of a sudden, the idea that as a broke individual, I actually had the power to affect the conversation. It's like, okay, I shouldn't squander this maybe with just like a silly wrestling reference. Maybe I should try to evolve this into something a little more meaningful.
So a ton to ask there. First of all, on the billboard of the candidate, did you turn him into Andre the Giant or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it was Buddy Cianci facing the public with his hand up saying, Cianci never stopped caring about Providence. What I didn't know was that he had been removed from office. He had been mayor and had been removed from office for beating up his estranged wife's lover, who also was a city contractor, having the cops hold him down in his house while he urinated on him, put cigars out on him. And so he had to, he had to resign and then was facing criminal prosecution. But then when he got through all that, he came back and was like, Cianci, he never stopped caring about Providence, didn't care for his wife or her lover so much, but you know, hey, it's Providence, you know. So I actually didn't know the backstory, but what I accidentally did, I just thought it was a dumb billboard that didn't say anything about an issue, and was conveniently located by the school. So I put a sign in his hand that said "Join the Posse" and changed the head to Andre, and then put 7'4", 520 pounds on his lapel. But people saw that and they thought, oh, this artist is so, that who did this is so brilliant. They're making the comparison between Cianci the Brute and Andre the Brute. And that was completely accidental. So, I was somewhat Trumpian. And then I'm just like bouncing around, not knowing what I'm doing. And people accidentally liked it. But,
That's so interesting. But obviously the rest of your career indicates not Trumpian.
Well, you know, I do learn, you know. Yeah. Some people don't learn.
No, and the other thing is that it's the idea and the effort and the initiative in the first place that gets rewarded. And that initiative then is seen throughout the rest of your career as well. So then when do you, there's so much I want to ask you, when do you then morph Andre the Giant into Obey?
That was a couple years later, and I saw the film They Live. Have you ever seen that film?
No.
It's a John Carpenter film, and in that film, coincidentally, Rowdy Roddy Piper, the former wrestler who also wrestled with Andre some, finds these special glasses that when he puts them on, he can see that half the people, the authoritarians, are aliens. The ads say things like not vacation in Tahiti, but obey, consume, sleep, conform, watch television, marry and reproduce. And you know, symbolically, it was really powerful. It was a B movie, but with a profound concept that most people are too unaware of manipulation to address it consciously. And so, you know, watching that film, the word that stuck out to me as the thing that people do the most, follow the path of least resistance subconsciously, but when they're aware of it, when they're conscious of it, that they resist vigorously, is obey. So I want to crystallize that. I want to pull it out of the ether, the unseen hand of manipulation, and make it the visible manipulation that you have to deal with.
And did you attach it to Andre the Giant because that had already had a life of its own?
Exactly.
Okay.
An evolution. So I took Andre in a direction where I streamlined him, so he was more like a big brother's watching you figure. So, you know, I loved Orwell, and when I They Live was you know, had for sure connections to dystopian literature like Orwell or Ray Bradbury. And also the set design was very similar to an artist who I loved named Barbara Kruger, who you've probably seen her work, Your Body is a Battleground, about reproductive rights, where it's a woman's face, positive, negative, split in half with a red bar with the white Futura type that says Your Body is a Battleground, which is the same type style used in They Live and the same type style that I use for Obey. So, you know, I wear my influences on my sleeve.
And sometimes literally too, yes. I don't know whether to love or not your story of selling the t-shirts without your boss's permission, because it's awesome initiative, entrepreneurial, great spirit, except I run this place and I don't want anybody getting ideas. okay, you do Obey, connected to Andre the Giant, but how does that spring out of Providence and all over the country?
Because I was very motivated to disseminate my work. And that was a combination of driving my beat up station wagon from Providence to Boston, New York, Philly, DC. I mean, at one point, all the way down to Florida and back, using different routes both ways to cover more territory, taking flights to San Francisco, San Diego, LA from the East Coast. But mostly, I think, it was because I created sort of a, you know, like a punk rock network of people who were getting my stickers. I would run ads in places like Slap Skateboard Magazine, Flipside Punk Magazine, Maximum Rock and Roll Punk Magazine. And I would have these funny ads that were sort of, you know, cryptic, but would say, for stickers in the lowdown, send a self-addressed stamped envelope. And they were first coming to my art school PO box and then to my house. And I was getting, you know, starting off like one or two letters a week to, you know, like 20 letters every day. And I would send back my manifesto, which was not really a manifesto at first. It just started off as a slightly condensed version of a paper I wrote about Heidegger and phenomenology and some things I'd witnessed, social phenomena I'd witnessed around my sticker campaign. But it actually, when people got it, they felt like, okay, I intuitively responded to this, but now I have an intellectual rationale for it. And that's empowering to people. So I sent that, I sent a proof sheet, I sent stickers, and then I sent instructions on how to go to a copy shop and make your own stickers if you wanted to. So it became like a punk rock viral chain letter, you know, before internet viral memes.
Super interesting. So when you're going up and down, are you putting stickers on like buildings and stop signs and stuff, or are you doing big billboard takeovers and stuff?
Well, it started off with stencils, smaller posters, stickers, but then as the years went on, I got more sophisticated in what I was doing, which still isn't very sophisticated, but sophisticated enough to go use the blueprint copier to make larger things and figuring out percentages to get things to go up, tiled up, bigger to take over billboards or, you know, sides of buildings. And I was convinced that the smaller stuff is great, but the bigger stuff is what makes the smaller stuff feel meaningful to people, because a lot of times people don't notice the smaller stuff until they see something bigger, because that, you know, the effort of that endeavor is really, it's visceral for people. And so I knew that I had to do all of it. And you know, some friends of mine were like, wow, you know, you're competing with Coca-Cola with this thing. Like, you know, you're as ubiquitous as those guys. And you know, this was long before I read Naomi Klein's No Logo. And you know, you could point out the irony that I was doing sort of an anti-branding campaign, which then eventually I had products for. So it became something that I initially really didn't have any products for, but I was getting very far into debt doing it. And so I started to make some t-shirts for some friends and some posters. I would print 100 posters on thin paper just to put up on the street and 100 on thick paper hypothetically to sell. But for years, no one bought those. They just stacked up in my studio and I gave them to people that would help me print and things like that. But you know, my idea was this sort of way of sustaining my creativity by having a sales component, but that was really driving attention for the street art, the ideas. Even if the idea of selling and then questioning consumption seemed a bit contradictory, I was willing to live not being a trust fund kid with wrestling with that contradiction.
Yeah, it always comes back to wrestling. and it's funny how we grew up the same and different. So I loved Andre the Giant and Rowdy Roddy Piper, even when he smashed the coconut over Snuka's head, which was so wrong. On the other hand, instead of liking punk, I liked the Pointer Sisters, and I liked Reagan. So, but don't hold it against me. I also evolved. we wind up getting to a similar place. But so in your evolution, I'm sure this is the question you probably get most often, but I want to ask it, I hope, in a little bit more thoughtful way, understanding the contradictions and the ironies and all that. But the question is, okay, but when you take over somebody's billboard or you put it on somebody's building or you, etc., do you feel bad about that? Are you supposed to feel bad that somebody else's property, that's somebody else's project maybe even? Mm-hmm. Yeah, just talk me through how you feel about that.
Well, I definitely evolved on that, because when I was younger and I was broke and I thought, the rest of the world is doing great and just out to ruin my life and make me miserable. I didn't feel like I had any obligation to be courteous to anyone. I felt like it was me against the world. My thinking on that shifted. And like when I changed around Cianci's billboard, my excuse was it's in my right of way and it's annoying. I don't think that way now. I don't want to cost anyone money. And that applies to buildings as well. I'm always trying to put my work on either public property where I can say, I'm a taxpayer also, and this is this is taxpayer space, or abandoned property where I don't feel like a poster on a boarded up window or something that's already got a lot of graffiti on it and is dilapidated, where it's going to really cause damage. And so, the idea that public space can be used in a positive way for empowering people who don't have deep pockets without being destructive, that's sometimes that's threading the needle, but it's what I'm striving for all the time. And I try to now set a strong example for younger people who are street artists that there is sort of a code of ethics to the way I apply my stuff. In the late 90s, I did take over several Sprite Obey Your Thirst billboards where I just covered Your Thirst up with one of my icon faces. Then I realized that was probably a lot of money's worth of Sprite advertising, and I have no emotional connection to Sprite, but whether it's the people who have to go out and replace the billboard or it's somebody at Sprite who gets yelled at because they made the design of that billboard too alluring for a punk like me, I just started to think about how it would impact others. So I've taken over a lot of billboards, but almost all of them since then have been blank.
That's interesting. So how would you feel about someone who's coming up who says, screw your ethics, I'm gonna do it my way?
Well, what I would say to them is, if you wanna have a long career, I think it's a lot smarter to be able to stand behind your actions once you're pulled out of the shadows. Because it eventually happens to everybody. I've been arrested 18 times. Everybody thinks they're invincible until they realize they're not. Who are your real enemies? What's the point you're trying to make? I now try to be very specific about who I'm willing to go up against and why, and I want to do that thoughtfully. And some people are. They're not there yet, and that's maybe they're never gonna be there. So I just say to them, okay, you're in control of your own destiny, but be prepared for the consequences if you throw the middle finger up at everybody.
Got you. And you just used a phrase that was interesting. So you said you gotta know who your enemies are. So who are your enemies?
Any purveyors of injustice, and that's whether it's racial, environmental, I'm working on so many different issues. I'm working on xenophobia, racism, sexism, environmental destruction. Campaign finance reform, I think, is really important. We need to minimize the influence of corporations that undermines democracy. There's some, just anybody that's they're putting themselves ahead of the greater public good.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Campaign finance reform, obviously you gotta get money out of politics, otherwise we're doomed. But I feel like, so that's a huge, huge part of it. But the part that people don't talk about that much is the corporate takeover. It's not just rich folks who have money who donate to politicians and want lower taxes. It's that corporations have gotten their tentacles into almost everything we do. Give me your take on that. Is there, other than obey, is there anything we can do to fight back? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, we have a huge amount of power in how we spend our money. So knowing what companies we support and which ones we don't, people who are short on funds saying, well, I have to go to Walmart. Like, but you're helping to perpetuate a cycle, which means that those Walmart employees that don't get full time and don't get benefits, what you're doing is you're making sure that by not boycotting them, that the message isn't sent to them that they need to change their behavior. There's so a vote. Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot of people don't vote. When you look at millennials are the biggest voting, or I think it's 18 to 29 is the biggest voting block now that voted in the smallest numbers percentage wise. I think that when, even though the, Princeton, the Princeton study that showed that effectively democracy is really not functioning anymore. It's what corporate and special interests want. But I actually think if a higher percentage of people voted, that might shift more in the right direction. It's still going to be corrupted a good bit by all that influence. Spending and voting would make a really big difference.
I like that philosophy because it turns consumption in some ways against them. It weaponizes the thing that the corporations use to control folks. So, okay, they do it as a form of control, but you could do it as a form of controlling them.
Exactly. And I mean, most of the things that we buy, maybe other than if you've got a gas car, you need gasoline, you need groceries. But a lot of the things that we buy are discretionary. And if you don't like aspects of how Apple's doing its thing, you don't have to buy an iPhone. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to pick on anyone specific here, but it's people I think are confused about what they need and what they just want. And if you have the willingness to complain about the way things are, but not the willingness to research who's doing what and how you could, maybe change their habits by changing your own habits. That's a problem. My wife and I, before 2016, started this initiative called Make America Smart Again. And the whole idea was just take a minute to learn about the issues that affect you.
Mm-hmm. But, bless your heart. Watch more Young Turks.
Yeah, for sure.
Join Wolfpack. Get money out of politics. So, why is a kid in Charleston, South Carolina, who is white? I don't know if you know that. cares so much about xenophobia and racism, etc. Like, how did that thought get into your head, especially growing up back then?
Probably because I am from there, and. My grandfather was president of a small college in Rock Hill, South Carolina, called Winthrop, and they were the second school to willingly implement the non-segregation in school. And my grandfather wrote about the residual effects of Jim Crow, but I really didn't know any of that. It was mostly just my parents. I asked my parents, why is it that everybody that lives on that side of the town is poor and black, and this side is not as poor and white? And so they tried to delicately explain to me the legacy of slavery, and and all the things that were ongoing. That made a difference to me. And then I got into a lot of black music. I got into Bob Marley. I got into Public Enemy, Run DMC, Boogie Down Productions, N.W.A. And Public Enemy was probably the most positive influence because they were talking about Malcolm X, about the Black Panthers. And then I read Bobby Seale's Seize the Time. But I just think that racism and xenophobia are they're based on people's insecurity and an unwillingness to admit vulnerability. So you'd rather scapegoat instead. And I'd like for us to all say, like, hey, I'm paraphrasing the Dalai Lama. We have a lot more in common to bond over than differences that we should be arguing over, yet we're spending all this time bickering over the differences. Because I think if people got past racism, xenophobia, and sexism, they'd actually look at where the real abuses of power are.
You know, so much of it goes back to that the movie you were talking about, in at least as I'm, you know, hearing your life story. Because, you know, I was just in Charleston, South Carolina, and there's all of these incredible things like the slave mart that's in the middle of town. Mm-hmm. And if you want, you can go and see this is how they bought and sold human beings. And it's amazing and it's jarring. And then you can go to a plantation and you can see how folks lived and the different rules and how they had to obey. Yeah. And you almost have to try not to see it. And I think that a lot of people try really hard not to see things. Mm-hmm. So, like in the movie you were describing, like, so here's what the aliens see, here's what you see. But it's true for us now a lot, and then a lot of times here's what the right wing sees and here's what the left wing sees. And even though it's the same thing, we're seeing it completely differently. And it is a hell of a thing to bridge. In a sense, when you give me the Dalai Lama quote, it sounds like you want to bridge it, and I do too. But and again, there's so many similarities, just coincidentally similarities. Earlier today, I was talking on the show about how Public Enemy was such a huge influence. The Pointer Sisters and Public Enemy. And Run DMC and all those guys that I used to listen to. But I said Public Enemy was the top because it opened up my mind and it let me see a different perspective. So on the other hand, I want to fight the bad guys. And you talk about fighting the bad guys. Yeah. So how do we balance out attacking, for example, let's just keep it real. Let's call it what it is, attacking the right wing and saying that's not right and I'm going to fight you. And saying, on the other hand, I'd like to build a bridge so we could actually see the same billboard, if you will.
Well, you know, I've utilized both strategies, and it's very cathartic to just rage and say you're a villain, screw you. And I've done that, and I, you know, and I get a nice pat on the back from like-minded peers, and that, you know, that can be great. That can actually, when you're feeling terrible, that can be really helpful, but that doesn't, from a just, you know, a therapy standpoint, but it actually doesn't solve the problem. So what I've been doing more recently a lot of times is trying to find something universal in what I'm putting out. And then there's a subtext of me, you know, sometimes it's humorous, sometimes it's, you know, it subversive, but there's something that it seduces the viewer, hopefully, that we can all, that's common ground, and then says, but you're not getting it quite right. And, you know, for example, something that a lot of the new work that I put in my Damage show that was dealing with sexism and racism, all the stats about police frisking and shooting unarmed African Americans and the bias in sentencing. You know, that you were drawn in to read that text by a very, I think, human appealing portrait of a woman. So I've been trying this sort of two-pronged approach. With something like the We the People series, the Trump calling Latinos rapists and Muslims terrorists, and you know, on down the line, you know, women have low IQs, you know, these sorts of things. What I felt with a lot leading up to the Women's March around the inauguration was that everything's so polarized right now that I need to make some images that just sort of are so positive and should be universally positive that if you try to find fault with them, you're really outing yourself as a bigot.
And
you know, the give them enough rope strategy. I actually don't want to give them any more rope. They've already had too much rope.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
But anyway.
Is that one right there, Shepard? Like that's from We the People campaign?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and then using some symbols like the American flag. Because why should the American flag be hijacked by the right wing when really To me, the flag is a symbol of the melting pot of, you know, diverse ideas, diverse backgrounds, ethnicities, religions, and so you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is not, to me, what should, you know, always define the American flag. Everyone's equally American.
Yeah, so that's why when we do the Young Turks regularly, we have the American flag behind us, because that's not their flag, that's our flag.
Right.
So it's the flag that unifies. So sometimes people say, oh, Confederate flag, you guys don't understand. No, I understand. The Confederate flag was flown by the Confederacy into battle. The flag on the opposite side of that battle was the American flag.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And we were called the Union. Now, I wasn't here, my ancestors weren't here, but it's we because when I became a citizen, that's what I adopted. And I adopted this heritage. And yes, some of the heritage has some awful parts to it. And yes, the heritage has some wonderful parts to it. And we could emphasize those and not let them hijack the flag, the Constitution, yeah, and America overall, because America does have some great parts that we could use, like, and some of it was created for a marketing campaign, right? But you know what we could do? Kind of along the lines of what you're saying, we can co-opt the marketing campaign. Like, we can make it our own and hijack it and say, no, that's ours now. It's kind of how you did with the billboards.
Well, the you know, symbols can be used to manipulate. They can make people lazy, but they also have power. And I think to accept that that's a huge part of sort of our language of communication, and for me, try to redefine things in a more positive direction when possible, or point out how they're tools of manipulation at other times. You know, that's just part of what I do as a visual artist. But you know, some people would rather say, you know, let's not define things by this or that, but it's that's just how we are as human beings. We want to put things in categories, label things, use symbols around things. And so, you know, I'm constantly playing with that. You know, sometimes trying to, for example, the American flag, say this should actually be a symbol of diversity. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of things are coded. We know that. You know,
yeah.
It's not a, you know, I have white pride now, not I'm, I hate all of the races, you know, the change,
right,
shifts.
Right, right.
People get smart about how they.
Well, they were until Trump came along and he's like, no, I meant I hate other races.
Right.
And people are like, oh, wait, oh yeah, that's me too.
Right?
But I want to go back to We the People, because I'm seeing those posters everywhere. I'm seeing them at the protests. So what's the genesis of that?
Well, I worked with a friend of mine, photographer Aaron Huey, who started a foundation called Amplifier. He and I had done a lot of work around Native American rights for a thing, an initiative called Honor the Treaties. He spent a lot of time documenting the Lakota and the Pine Ridge Reservation, and came to me and said, you know, I'd love it if you'd make some illustrations based on my pieces. And I think that was a great initiative, but he found it difficult to be a white guy doing that, because he was, you know, for better or worse, accused of being a white savior. And I think he was trying to do good work, but we all know that identity politics are very tricky. And but he wanted, you know, he really cares about social justice and people, so he wanted to transition to doing something else. And when Trump was elected, he decided, we need to work on some stuff. We also worked with several other artists and photographers, and you know, it was actually a very diverse group. I was probably the best known artist in the group, but a woman named Jessica Sabagal did some posters. Ernesto Urena did some posters. The photographers for each subject were, it was a Latina photographer who shot the Latina I illustrated, a Muslim photographer who shot the Muslim woman I illustrated, et cetera. And you know, we didn't expect to get a lot of traction for the campaign just because things had been so divided and hostile. But I think it was the thing that people were looking for some bit of positive hope in that moment. And you know, I've done the whole hope thing before.
Yeah.
So I should have known it was a winning formula. No, I mean, that was probably after Trump was elected is probably the worst I've felt maybe in my life. But I also felt like I need to do whatever I can. So working with Aaron on those images, we did a Kickstarter, and it was the most supported art Kickstarter ever. And then the money raised took out ads in USA Today, Washington Post, New York Times, and printed posters that were disseminated at the marches in LA, DC, and other places. And then continued to print posters for dissemination. And you know, there was the funds from that Kickstarter drive are still helping to pay for new initiatives.
I'm learning all these mysteries one by one as we go through the interview. So let's get to Obama then. You mentioned the hope poster that everybody knows. So how did that come about? And it wasn't originally hope underneath, right? It was progress?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I had done a lot of work that was pushing back against the Iraq War, the Patriot Act, the Bush agenda, basically. And then when Obama spoke at the DNC in 2004, I was impressed with his oratory skills, mm-hmm. and started to look at some of his policy positions and saw that he had opposed the Iraq War, which was a very unpopular position at that time. Mm-hmm. Looked at him talking about green jobs, green economy, reducing the power of lobbyists, universal health care, raising environmental standards, things like that. I thought, okay, if I'm willing to oppose Bush, I should be willing to support this guy. And I'd never really done anything for a mainstream candidate, and in fact, my whole brand really was rebellion. But you know, when I saw a lot of Obama's positions as what I saw at the time to be kind of the antithesis of Bush's positions, whether it worked out in application when he was in office like that or not, I thought I should support this guy vigorously. But I had just done a big art show in New York called E Pluribus Venom.
That's fun.
And I thought there's the possibility that I'm going to be too controversial for Obama to be interested in my endorsement. You know, he had sort of brushed off Farrakhan's endorsement, and you know, mm-hmm. I'm not comparing myself to Farrakhan, but yeah, you know, I know how awkward it is for politicians when somebody that's too controversial is like, "Hey, I love you, man."
I wouldn't know anything about that.
So, but I had a friend who knew some people in the Obama campaign, and first of all, I just wanted permission to create a poster in support of Obama that I would do on my own. And that was a guy named Yossi Surjant, and he got the yes back. Obama had seen what I'd done around the 2004 election. I'd done some stuff with Punk Voter and some anti-Bush stuff, and he liked it and said, yeah, tell him to go ahead. So I illustrated the hope poster. It initially said progress underneath. I put 350 up for sale on my website, made 350 to put up on the street, and then used the money from the first 350 to print 10,000 offset prints, which were just given away. And that was a few days after the Iowa caucus. And all of a sudden, Obama went from, when I was talking to people about doing this poster, they're like, why bother? Hillary juggernaut's gonna crush him. Like, don't, yeah. I said, well, if I'm gonna do it, I need to do it now. I wanna, you know, be helpful as soon as possible. But you know, then all of a sudden, when he wins Iowa, people go, "Whoa, hey, this guy, you know, maybe he has a chance." And that just happened to be timed when I put the image free download up on my website, gave the Oprah rally for Obama in LA 10,000 posters, and then Obama ends up on a video pointing to the poster, saying, "I really love this poster." And then it became this viral thing I didn't expect. But the interesting thing was the first posters said progress, but then I got the communication from the campaign that was sort of, they didn't say these exact words, but you know, progress is a little too close to progressive, which is a little close to Marxist.
Ay, ay, ay.
You know what I mean? So it's like,
which was a sign of things to come.
Yeah. So let's, you know, let's use hope or change. And but hope and change were both things that simple, you know, not you know, kind of dumb, easy words. But also, when people feel hopeless, I think that simple things like that matter. So I was cool with that.
Yeah, quick side comment is that to give you a sense of how little the mainstream media knows, and they keep insisting, like again, talking about the alternate realities that people see. How many times has the mainstream media said that Hillary Clinton is invincible? Come to find out that it's not the case. And as I kept screaming all the way from 2007 through 2016, she is not invincible. I've seen her get defeated several times,
right?
Yeah. And they're like, ah, you're the crazy one, right? So now Obama, you do that poster, it works great, wonderful. After 8 years, what was your sense?
Well, my feelings were very mixed about Obama. You know, on the one hand, I do think he's a very high quality human being. He's a classy guy. I've met him a few times, and I think I'm a reasonable judge of character. And our family was actually in the White House the day after the election. I think he was assuming that it was going to be a day of celebration, and it ended up being a much darker day. But he was funny, composed, generous, dignified, thoughtful, everything you would want from somebody in their worst moment, which that has to have been one of his worst moments. And he was keeping it together a lot better than I could.
Day after the Trump election.
The day after the Trump election, yeah. But, you know, Obama was sabotaged by the Republicans, but I think he suffered from that, you know, the curse that many politicians do, which is they want to be liked. And so he starts backpedaling where, you know, the squeaky wheels he attended to rather than saying, you're never going to agree with me anyway, so sit over on the sides and whine, that's fine, and we'll let the adults handle some business over here. You know, things like defending domestic spying when that all came out, and you know, there were a lot of deportations under Obama. There are the drone, I think drones are basically a tool of terrorism that we're using.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can't support that. You know, I can't, you know, if given the choice, okay, it's either put troops on the ground and start another war or have drones, I don't like that choice. I'd probably choose drones, but I'd rather neither. Can the choice be neither?
Yeah, it can. We're just choosing not to have it be neither.
Right. But many people don't position it that way. They, you know, many politicians position it as you have to choose one or the other.
Yeah. No, we don't. We refuse to obey. So let's talk about the Equal Justice Initiative. So what is that? You're working on it now. What is it?
Yeah, so there's a lawyer named Brian Stevenson who he wrote a book called Just Mercy. He's done a lot of basically about the legacy of slavery. He is he's opening a museum in Montgomery, Alabama that is looking at the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, mass incarceration, right up to the moment. And what he's saying is that this isn't about opening old wounds, it's about acknowledging wounds and helping them heal. That until, you know, white people face up, and he's looking at the model of what's happened in South Africa, acknowledging apartheid, what's happened in Germany, acknowledging the Holocaust, that we really haven't done that about slavery yet in the United States. And the great thing is he is, he's a healer. He's not an antagonist, but he's somebody that says, like, we need group therapy. And that's what he's going for. But he asked me to design the invitation to the opening of the museum. And they're going to create shirts and posters. They're going to be free giveaway posters. But, you know, it's amazing. John Legend, Oprah, a bunch of great people are going to be there. And I helped to create the, you know, the identity for the launch. And I'm sure somebody's going to say, you know, they should have had a black guy do it. And that might be true, that symbolically it would have been great for a black guy to do it. But I also think that symbolically, to show that, you know, we're like-minded partners here, we're allies, is really important. And you know, I'm always, if I'm asked to do something for a cause like this and I have the time, I want to do it because I'm an ally.
Yeah, so let's talk about the goal of this, and then that'll get us into a conversation about goals overall. So what's the ideal scenario for the Equal Justice Initiative? What I don't know that there's, like, for example, Wolfpack, get money out of politics. There's a very specific goal, yeah, to get an amendment, right, that gets money out of politics.
Yeah.
I don't know that this needs that specific a goal, but has there been a discussion about, hey, this would be great if we could get this done?
Well, the goal is to create an awareness of the systemic bias, create empathy in people that experience it, because always looking at anyone tangled up in the criminal justice system as other, especially if they're non-white, is really problematic for people getting true justice. And so Brian is doing a lot of things around defending people. He's gotten a lot of people off death row who were wrongly convicted. So it's an innocence project-esque thing he's been doing for years and years and years. But I think that in doing that, seeing all the evidence of bias, he wanted to go bigger picture with it. And I think that, you know, the idea is to have us as a nation evolve towards greater sensitivity that prevents things from happening as frequently, like unarmed black or Latino men being killed by the police on such a regular basis.
Right. In a sense, you going to the billboards was the bigger picture. So some symbolism, sure, in that too. Yeah. So you're also doing Stop the Violence. So what is that about?
Well, I've done a lot around gun obsession, our gun culture in the United States, and it's probably the issue I get the most hostile feedback on. But especially with March for Our Lives happening and seeing all the amazing, impassioned, eloquent speeches given by the Parkland, the students. To me, it was an important moment to create some work that could be used as downloads, posters, and I just want fewer people to be killed by guns. And you know how we get there. There are a lot of different paths to get there. But the interesting thing is, everyone who loves guns, like the way they, I really think it's as irrational as if you told a guy you're going to take his gun that you were going to neuter him at the same time for certain people. Some women too. So whatever the female castration thing is, but it's an emotional thing that is very hard to get those gun lovers to think rationally about the issue. You tell them, well, look at these countries in Europe where there are far fewer deaths. They say, oh yeah, well that's because they're all just taking box trucks and running people down or using knives. And you can't.
It's just not true, but they
say it's not. Right. Yeah, it's not true, but. But you know, a lot of times, even if I feel like I'm, you know, maybe spitting into the wind with things I'm doing, from a legislative standpoint, I don't know what it's going to achieve legislatively. I think that having the courage to, when it's so unpopular, to say, you know what, I don't think we all need guns. I think it actually takes a lot more courage to have to use your brain and use your words to solve problems. That if I'm willing to say that, then other people who've been intimidated and on the sidelines might have the courage to join the conversation, and that can move the needle.
Yeah, well, this is the part where I get a little antagonistic with the other side, because I think that the gun for them, it has become a part of their identity. And whenever you touch anyone's identity, that's when they get really, really upset and irrational, etc. And look, that could, the identity issue could apply to both sides and in different ways. And you know, I don't, the whole phallic thing, and I get it, but I don't think that's really what's driving them. But so what's, which part is antagonistic? I think that the conservative mind is more centered around fear. So, and there have been studies that show literally have a larger amygdala in some cases. And but then the culture revolves in some places around that fear of the others, fear of the Muslims and the Mexicans and people that don't look like you. And if your whole drive is around fear, then what is the one product you're desperately going to cling to? Guns.
Right. And you know, it's wrapped in an American flag because of the Second Amendment, not taking into account that, you know, the Second Amendment was written when there was no standing army and you needed the ability to have a militia in case the British came back real quick. And you could load, you know, one shot a minute. It's just a different thing. And when people say, oh, you can't change it, it's like, it's already changed. It's an amendment. Look up the definition of amendment.
So yeah, I often talk about how the founding fathers were revolutionaries, and hence they built revolution into the document. And those are called amendments. Right. So instead of picking up a musket, you pick up a ballot or whatever it takes to get an amendment. So I couldn't agree more with you. Besides which, the Second Amendment, as you say, it says, for a well-regulated militia. We don't actually have to change it. You're not a well-regulated militia. You just aren't, and apparently have trouble reading. So that's right. Me getting antagonistic again. Okay, so, but anyways, I wanna go through some of the other stuff. Your book, Obey Supply and Demand, that has your artwork in it. I get that, right? So, so Obey Giant, the movie, the documentary that we talked about, that's on Hulu. Mm-hmm. What's in that?
Well, that's pretty much the story of my life, you know, up until this past November when it aired. But it's made by a guy named James Mole, who is a great documentary filmmaker. He won an Academy Award for a film called Last Days about the end of the Holocaust and the discovery of Auschwitz. It's a really very heavy film, but it's really just the story of my art and my life, and a lot of the, you know, the struggles and successes and, you know, everything in between, my relationship with my wife. I think it turned out really well, and a lot of people know bits and pieces of my story, but you know, if you're willing to spend an hour and a half, you get a pretty good understanding of you know, what's been going on with me, what drives me, and what art I've made.
Right, and by the way, the website is obeygiant.com. That's your website. Yeah. Obviously, Hulu has a documentary, but all the links that we talked about will be in the description box, so you can click on them if you're watching later on YouTube or in the comment section on Facebook. So to finish, if you had a goal, right, for your career, what would it be?
It's funny, I guess you're always moving the goal line, right? I mean, I've surpassed almost all my goals, but I'm a very restless, dissatisfied person, not in the moment. I mean, when I take a deep breath, I know how fortunate I am. But I think my goal is to just be able to keep creating and using my voice and being able to survive financially. I mean, that's actually miraculous. Most people cannot do that. So I feel like as long as I can keep doing that, you know, I take the fact that I have an audience very seriously. I try to be thoughtful about the things I'm doing, but you know, I'm not. I can't always predict the future. It's interesting to be blamed that some people supported Obama and then didn't like the result, and they were like, "I liked your poster." It's because of that. But so you know, I'm going to be as thoughtful about everything I do with the knowledge I have up to that point as I can be, and you know, try to be someone just making art that's both hopefully visually appealing, but also you know, creating a conversation that wouldn't happen otherwise and move things in a good direction. You know, my role models are Bob Marley, Public Enemy, The Clash, The Dead Kennedys, Rage Against the Machine, and you know, and then a few visual artists too. And I just like to be able to keep pushing forward with that.
Makes sense. All right, Shepherd Ferry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so
really
much.
Appreciate it.